than they had done to begin with, but she didn't seem to mind. She walked through, stopping at each and every room. It was like she was trying to commit them to memory. Or retrieve them from memory. Cassandra wondered how much Nell had told Julia about the reason for her interest. "Did you show her the cottage, too?" "No, but I sure as hell mentioned it to her. Then I crossed my fingers, and everything else I could manage to cross." She laughed. "We were that desperate for a buyer. We were going broke, just as surely as if we'd dug a hole beneath the house and tossed every last pound into it. We'd had the cottage on the market for a while, you see. Almost sold it twice to Londoners looking for a holiday home, but both contracts fell through. Rotten luck. We dropped the price, but there was no way we could get a local to buy it, not for love nor money. Spectacular views, and no one interested because of some silly old rumors." "Robin told me." "As far as I can see, there's something wrong with your house in Cornwall, if it isn't haunted," said Julia lightly. "We've got our very own ghost at the hotel. But you already know that. I hear you met her the other night." Cassandra's puzzlement must have shown on her face, for Julia continued, "Samantha on the front desk told me you reported a key in your door." "Oh," said Cassandra, "yeah, I thought it was another guest, but it must have been the wind. I didn't mean to cause any, 'That's her, all right, that's our ghost.'" Julia laughed at Cassandra's expression of perplexity. "Oh, now, don't you be alarmed. She won't do you any harm. She's not an unfriendly ghost, exactly. I wouldn't keep an unfriendly ghost." Cassandra had the feeling that Julia was pulling her leg. All the same, she'd heard more talk of ghosts since she'd arrived in Cornwall than she had since she was 12 years old and went to her first slumber party. "I suppose every old house needs one," she ventured.
"Precisely," said Julia. "People expect it. I'd have had to invent one if there hadn't been one here already. A historic hotel like this. Why, a resident ghost is as important to guests as clean towels."
She leaned forward. "Ours even has a name. Rose Mountrachet. She and her family used to live here, back at the start of the 20th century. Well, before that, if you consider the family went back hundreds of years. That's her in the picture, hanging by the bookcase in the foyer. The young woman with pale skin and dark hair. Have you seen it?" Cassandra shook her head.
"Oh, you must," said Julia. "It's a John Singer Sargent, painted a few years after he did the Wyndham sisters."
"Really?" Cassandra's skin cooled. "An actual John Singer Sargent?" Julia laughed.
"Incredible, isn't it? Another of the house's secrets. I didn't realize its value myself until a few years ago. We had a fellow out from Christie's to look at another painting, and he spotted it. I call it my nest egg. Not that I could ever bear to part with it. Such a beauty was our Rose, and such a tragic life. A delicate child who overcame ill health, only to die at 24 in a dreadful accident." She sighed romantically. "Have you finished your breakfast? Come with me and I'll show you the painting." Rose Mountrachet, at 18, was fair indeed. White skin, a cloud of dark hair swept back in a loose braid, and the full bosom so fashionable in the period. Sargent was renowned for his ability to discern and capture the personality of his sitters, and Rose's gaze was soulful. Red lips relaxed in repose, but eyes that remained watchful, fixed on the artist. It was a seriousness of expression that fitted with what Cassandra imagined of a girl who'd spent her entire childhood imprisoned by ill health. She leaned closer. The portrait's composition was interesting. Rose was seated on a sofa, a book in her lap. The sofa was angled away from the frame so that Rose was in the right-hand foreground, and behind her was a wall papered in green, but with little other detail. The way the wall was rendered gave it a sense of being pale and feathery, more impressionistic than the realism for which Sargent was known. It was not unheard of for Sargent to use such techniques, but this seemed somehow lighter than his other work, less careful. "She was a beauty, wasn't she?" said Julia, sashaying over from the reception desk. Cassandra nodded distractedly. The date on the painting was 1907, not long before he swore off portraiture. Perhaps he had been growing tired of rendering the faces of the wealthy even then. "I see she's worked her spell on you. Now you know why I was so keen to enlist her as our ghost." She laughed, then noticed Cassandra hadn't. "Are you all right? You look a little peaky. Glass of water?" Cassandra shook her head. No, I'm fine, thanks. It's just the painting." She pressed her lips together, heard herself say, "Rose Maltrichet was my great-grandmother." Julia's eyebrows leapt. "I only found out recently." Cassandra smiled at Julia, embarrassed. No matter that it was the truth, she felt like an actor speaking soap opera lines. Bad soap opera lines. "I'm sorry. This is the first time I've seen a picture of her. It all feels very real suddenly." "Oh, my dear," said Julia, "I hate to be the one to break it to you, but I'm afraid you must be mistaken. Rose couldn't be your great-grandmother. She couldn't be anyone's great-grandmother. Her only child died when she was practically still a baby."
"Of scarlet fever."
"Poor little cherub, 4 years old." She looked sideways at Cassandra. "If you know about the scarlet fever, you must know that Rose's daughter died."
"I know people think that, but I also know it's not what really happened. It can't be."
"I've seen the headstone in the estate cemetery," said Julia gently. "Sweetest lines of poetry, so sad. I can show it to you if you'd like." Cassandra could feel her cheeks flushing as they always did when she sensed the outskirts of disagreement. "There may be a headstone, but there's no little girl buried there. Not Ivory Walker, at any rate." Julia's expression vacillated between interest and concern. "Go on." "When my grandmother was 21, she found out her parents weren't really her parents."
"She was adopted?"
"Sort of. She was found on a wharf in Australia when she was 4 years old, with nothing but a child's suitcase. It wasn't until she was 65 that her dad finally gave her the case, and she was able to start searching for information about her past. She came to England and spoke with people and researched, and all the while she kept a journal." Julia smiled knowingly.
"Which you have now."
"Exactly. That's how I know she found out that Rose's daughter didn't die. She was kidnapped." Julia's blue eyes searched Cassandra's face. Her cheeks had taken on a sudden flush.
"But if that were the case, wouldn't there have been a search? Wouldn't it have been all over the newspapers? Like what happened with the Lindbergh boy?"
"Not if the family kept it quiet."
"Why would they have done that? They'd have wanted everyone to know, surely."
Cassandra was shaking her head. "Not if they wanted to avoid scandal. The woman who took her was the ward of Lord and Lady Maltrichet, Rose's cousin." Julia gasped.
"Eliza took Rose's daughter?"
It was Cassandra's turn to look surprised.
"You know of Eliza?"
"Of course. She's quite famous in these parts." Julia swallowed.
"Let me get this straight. You think Eliza took Rose's daughter to Australia?"
"Put her on the boat to Australia, but didn't go herself. Eliza went missing somewhere between London and Maryborough. When my great-grandfather found Nell, she was all by herself on the wharf. That's why he took her home. He couldn't leave a child that age alone."
Julia was clicking her tongue. "To think of a little girl abandoned like that. Your poor grandmother. Terrible not to know one's origins. Certainly explains her eagerness to take a look at this place."
"That's why Nell bought the cottage," said Cassandra. Once she discovered who she was, she wanted to own a piece of her past.
Of course.
Julia lifted her hands, then dropped them again. That part makes perfect sense. I just don't know about the rest.
What do you mean?
Well, even if what you say is correct, if Rose's daughter survived, was kidnapped, wound up in Australia, I just can't believe Eliza had anything to do with it. Rose and Eliza were so close. More like sisters than cousins, the very best of friends.
She paused, seemed to run the equation once more through her mind, then exhaled decisively.
No, I just can't believe Eliza capable of such betrayal.
Julia's faith in Eliza's innocence didn't seem that of a dispassionate observer discussing a historical hypothetical.
What makes you so certain?
Julia indicated a pair of wicker chairs arranged in the bay window.
Come, sit for a moment. I'll have Samantha organize some tea.
Cassandra glanced at her watch. Her appointment with the gardener was drawing near, but she was curious about Julia's strength of conviction, the way she spoke of Eliza and Rose as one might of dear friends. She sat in the proffered chair while Julia mouthed, "Tea," in Samantha's glazed direction. As Samantha disappeared, Julia continued.
When we bought Blackhurst, it was in a complete mess. We'd always dreamed of running a place like this, but the reality resembled something out of a nightmare. You have no idea how much can go wrong in a house this size. It took us 3 years to make any headway at all. We worked solidly, nearly lost our marriage in the process. Nothing like rising damp and endless holes in the roof to drive a couple apart.
Cassandra smiled. I can imagine.
It's sad, really. The house was lived in and loved by the one family for so long, but in the 20th century, particularly after the First War, it was virtually abandoned. Rooms were boarded up, fireplaces sealed, not to mention the damage done by the army when they were here in the 40s. We sank every penny we had into the house. I was a writer way back when, a series of romantic novels in the 60s. Not exactly Jackie Collins, but I did all right. My husband was in banking, and we were confident we had enough to get this place up and running. She laughed. Huge underestimation. Huge. By our third Christmas, we'd almost run out of money and had little to show for it other than a marriage hanging by a few threads. We'd already sold most of the smaller parts of the estate, and by Christmas Eve, 1974, we were just about ready to throw in the towel, head back to London with our tails between our legs. Samantha appeared with a heavily loaded tray, jolted it onto the table, then hesitated before reaching for the teapot handle.
"I can pour it myself, Sam," said Julia, waving her away with a laugh. "I'm not the queen."
"Well, not yet."
She winked at Cassandra.
"Sugar?"
"Please."
Julia handed a cup of tea to Cassandra, took a sip of her own, then resumed her story. "It was freezing cold that Christmas Eve. A storm had blown in off the sea and was terrorizing the headland. We'd lost power, our turkey was going off in a warm fridge, and we couldn't remember where we'd put the new batch of candles. We were hunting in one of the upstairs rooms when a flash of lightning bathed the room in light, and the two of us noticed the wall." She rubbed her lips together in anticipation of her own punchline.
"In the wall, there was a hole."
"Like a mouse hole?"
"No, a square hole."
Cassandra frowned uncertainly.
"A little cavity in the stone," said Julia, "the sort of thing I dreamed of as a kid whenever my brother found my diaries. It had been hidden behind a tapestry that the painter pulled down earlier in the week."
She took a large slurp of tea before continuing.
"I know it sounds silly, but finding that hidey hole was like a good luck charm. Almost like the house itself was saying, 'All right, you've been here long enough with your banging and clanging. You've proved your intentions are true, so you can stay.' And I tell you, from that night onwards, things seemed easier somehow. Started to go right more often than they went wrong. Your grandmother turned up for one thing, eager to buy Cliff Cottage,
A fellow named Bobby Blake began bringing the garden back to life, and a couple of coat companies started bussing tourists in for afternoon teas. She was smiling at the memory, and Cassandra almost felt bad for interrupting. But what was it you found? What was in the hidey hole? Julia blinked at her. Was it something belonging to Rose?
Yes, said Julia, swallowing an excited smile. Yes, it was. Tied up with a ribbon was a collection of scrapbooks, one for each year, from 1900 up until 1913.
Scrapbooks? Plenty of young ladies used to keep them back then. It was a hobby wholeheartedly approved of by the powers that were, one of the few. A form of self-expression in which a young lady might be permitted indulgence without fears that she'd lost her soul to the devil. She smiled fondly. Oh, Rose's scrapbooks are no different from any other you might find in museums or attics all across the country. They're full of pieces of fabric, sketches, pictures, invitations, little anecdotes. But when I found them, I so identified with this young woman from almost a century before, her hopes and dreams and disappointments, that I've had a soft spot for her ever since. I think of her as an angel, watching over us.
Are the scrapbooks still here?
A guilty nod. I know I should donate them to a museum or to one of those local history mobs, but I'm rather superstitious and can't bear to part with them. For a little while I put them on display in the lounge, in one of the glass cabinets, but every time I caught a glimpse, I felt a wave of shame, as if I'd taken something private and made it public. I have them stored in a box in my room now, for want of somewhere better.
I'd love to see them.
Of course you would, my dear. And so you shall. Julia smiled brilliantly at Cassandra. I'm expecting a group booking in the next half hour, and Robin's got the rest of my week stitched up with festival arrangements. Can we say dinner Friday night, up in my apartment? Rick will be away in London, so we'll have a real girls' night. Pour over Rose's scrapbooks and have ourselves a good old weep. How does that sound?
Great, said Cassandra, smiling a little uncertainly. It was the first time anyone had ever invited her anywhere for a cry.
Chapter 30. Blackhurst Manor, 1907. Careful not to alter her position on the sofa and incur the portrait artist's wrath, Rose allowed her gaze to drop, so she could look upon the most recent page of her scrapbook. She'd been working on it all week, whenever Mr. Sargent had allowed them a rest from posing. There was a piece of the pale pink satin from which her birthday dress had been sewn, a ribbon from her hair, and at the bottom, in her best hand, she'd written out the lines from a poem by Lord Tennyson. But who hath seen her wave her hand, or at the casement seen her stand? Or is she known in all the land, the Lady of Shalott? How Rose identified with the Lady of Shalott, cursed to spend eternity in her chamber, forced always to experience the world at one remove. For hadn't she, Rose, spent most of her life similarly interred? But not any more. Rose had made a decision. No longer would she be shackled by the morbid prognoses of Dr. Matthews, the hovering concern of Mama. Though still delicate, Rose had learned that frailty begot frailty, that nothing caused light-headedness so surely as day after day of stifling confinement. She was going to open windows when she was hot. She might catch a chill, but then again she might not. She was going to live with every expectation of marrying, having children, growing old. And at long last, on the occasion of her 18th birthday, Rose was to look down on Camelot. Better than that, walk through Camelot. For after years of pleading, Mama had finally consented. Today, for the first time, Rose was to accompany Eliza to the Blackhurst Cove. Ever since she'd arrived 7 years before, Eliza had been bringing back tales from the cove. When Rose was lying in her warm, dark room, breathing the stale air of her latest illness, Eliza would burst through the door so that Rose could almost smell the sea on her skin. She would climb in beside Rose and put a shell, or a powdery cuttlefish, or a little piece of shingle in her hand, and then she would begin her story. And in her mind, Rose would see the blue sea, feel the warm breeze in her hair, the hot sand beneath her feet. Some of the tales Eliza invented, some she learned elsewhere. Mary, the maid, had brothers who were fishermen, and Rose suspected she enjoyed chatting when she should be working. Not to Rose, of course, but Eliza was different. All the servants treated Eliza differently, quite improperly, almost as if they fancied themselves her friends. Just lately, Rose had begun to suspect that Eliza was venturing beyond the estate, had maybe even spoken with a villager or two, for her tales had taken on a new edge. They were rich with the specifics of boats and sailing, mermaids and treasures, adventures across the sea, told in colourful language that Rose secretly savoured. And there was a more expansive look in their teller's eyes, as if she'd tasted the wicked things of which she spoke. One thing was certain. Mama would be livid to learn that Eliza had been into the village, mixed with common folk. It riled Mama enough that Eliza spoke with the servants. For that fact alone, Rose was able to bear Eliza's friendship with Mary. If Mama were to ask Eliza where she went, certainly Eliza wouldn't lie. Though what Mama could do, Rose wasn't sure. In all the years of trying, Mama had been unable to find a punishment that deterred Eliza. The threat of being considered improper meant nothing to Eliza. Being sent to the cupboard beneath the stairs only gave her time and quiet to invent more stories. Denying her new dresses, punishment indeed for Rose, garnered nary a sigh. Eliza was more than happy to wear Rose's cast-offs. When it came to punishments, she was like the heroine from one of her own stories, protected by a fairy charm. Watching Mama's thwarted attempts to discipline Eliza gave Rose illicit pleasure. Each bid was met with a blank, blue-eyed blink, a carefree shrug, and an unaffected, "Yes, Aunt," as if Eliza genuinely hadn't realized her behavior might cause offense. The shrug, in particular, drove Mama to fury. She had long ago released Rose from any expectation that she might shape Eliza into a proper young lady, was pleased enough that Rose had succeeded in convincing Eliza to dress appropriately. Rose had accepted Mama's praise and silenced the little voice whispering that Eliza had shed the tatty breeches only when she no longer fitted them. There was something broken inside Eliza, Mama said, like a piece of mirror in a telescope that prevented it from functioning properly, prevented her from feeling proper shame. As if she read Rose's thoughts, Eliza shifted beside her on the sofa. They had been sitting still for almost an hour, and resistance was emanating from Eliza's body. Numerous times Mr. Sargent had needed to remind her to stop frowning, to hold a position, while he amended part of his painting. Rose had heard him telling Mama the day before that he'd have been finished already, only the girl with hair afire refused to sit still long enough for him to capture her expression. Mama had shivered distastefully when he said that. She would have preferred that Rose were Mr. Sargent's sole subject, but Rose had put her foot down. Eliza was her cousin, her only friend. Of course she must be in the portrait. And then Rose had coughed a little, eyeing Mama from beneath her lashes, and the matter had been closed. And although the small, icy part of Rose savored Mama's displeasure, her insistence on Eliza's inclusion had been heartfelt. Rose had never had a friend before Eliza. The opportunity had never presented itself, and even if it had, what use did a girl, not long for life, have for friends? Like most children whom circumstance is accustomed to suffering, Rose had found she shared little in common with other girls her age. She had no interest in rolling hoops or tidying dolls' houses, and became quickly bored when faced with wearying conversations as to her favorite color, number, or song. But Eliza was not like other little girls. Rose had known that on the first day they met. Eliza had a way of seeing the world that was frequently surprising, of doing things that were completely unexpected, things that Mama couldn't bear. The best thing about Eliza, though, even better than her ability to rile Mama, was her storytelling. She knew so many wonderful tales, the likes of which Rose had never heard. Frightening stories that made Rose's skin prickle and her feet perspire. About the other cousin, and the London River, and a wicked bad man with a glinting knife. And of course her tale about the black ship that haunted the Blackhurst Cove. Even though Rose knew it to be another of Eliza's fictions, she loved to hear the story told. The phantom ship that appeared on the horizon, the ship that Eliza claimed to have seen and had spent many a summer's day in the cove hoping to see again. The one thing Rose had never been able to get Eliza to tell tales about was her brother, Sammy. She'd let slip his name only once, but had clammed up immediately when Rose probed further. It was Mama who informed Rose that Eliza had been a twin, had once had a brother cut from the same cloth, a boy who had died in a tragic way. Over the years, when she was lying alone in bed, Rose had liked to imagine his death. This little boy whose loss had done the impossible robbed Eliza, the storyteller, of words. Sammy's death had replaced Georgiana's escape as Rose's daydream of choice. She'd imagined him drowning, she'd imagined him falling, and she'd imagined him wasting away, the poor little boy who had come before her in Eliza's affections. "Sit still," said Mr. Sergeant, pointing his paintbrush in Eliza's direction. "Stop wriggling. You're worse than Lady Asquith's corgi." Rose blinked, was careful not to let her expression change, when she realized that Father had entered the room. He was standing behind Mr. Sergeant's easel, watching intently as the artist worked, frowning and tilting his head, the better to follow the brush strokes. Rose was surprised. She had never imagined her father had an interest in the fine arts. The only thing for which she knew him to bear fondness was photography, but even that he managed to make dull, never photographing people, only bugs and plants and bricks. Yet here he was, transfixed by his daughter's portrait. Rose sat a little taller. Only twice in her childhood had Rose been granted opportunity to observe her father at close quarters. The first instance was when she swallowed the thimble and Father had been called upon to take the photograph for Dr. Matthews. The second had not been so felicitous. She'd been hiding. Dr. Matthews was expected, and the 9-year-old Rose had taken it into her head she didn't feel like seeing him. She'd found the one place Mama would never think to seek her, Father's dark room. There was a cavity beneath the big desk, and Rose had taken a pillow to keep herself comfortable. And for the most part she was, if only the room hadn't had such a ghastly smell, like the cleaning lotions the servants used during the spring clean. She'd been there for 15 minutes or so when the door to the room opened. A thin beam of light passed through a tiny hole in the center of a timber knot at the back of the desk. Rose held her breath and pressed her eye against the hole, dreading the sight of Mama and Dr. Matthews coming for her. But it wasn't Mama or the doctor holding the door open. It was Father, dressed in his long black traveling cloak. Rose's throat constricted. Without ever having been properly told, she knew that the threshold to Father's dark room was one she should not cross. Father stood for a moment, silhouetted black against the bright outside. Then in he came, peeling off his coat and discarding it on an armchair, just as Thomas appeared, mortification paling his cheeks. "Your lordship," Thomas said, catching his breath, "we weren't expecting you until next..." "My plans were changed." "Cook is preparing luncheon, my lord," said Thomas, lighting the gas lamps on the wall. "I'll lay for two and tell Lady Maltrichet that you've returned." "No!" The suddenness with which this command was issued caused Rose's breath to catch. Thomas turned abruptly towards Father, and the match between his gloved fingers extinguished, victim of the sudden chill. "No," said Father again. The journey was long, Thomas. I need to rest.
A tray, sir?
And a decanter of sherry.
Thomas nodded, then disappeared through the door, footsteps fading down the hall. Rose could hear a thumping. She pressed her ear against the desk, wondering whether something in the drawer, some mysterious item belonging to Father, was ticking. Then she realized it was her own heart, pounding a warning against her chest, jumping for its life. But there was no escape, not while Father sat in his armchair, blocking the door. And so Rose, too, continued to sit, knees pulled tight against the traitorous heart which threatened to give her away. It was the only time she could remember being alone with Father. She noticed how his presence filled the room, so that a space, previously benign, now seemed charged with emotions and feelings Rose didn't understand. Dull footsteps on the rug, then a heavy masculine exhalation that made the hairs on her arms stand on end.
"Where are you?" Father said softly, then again from between clenched teeth. "Where are you?" Rose caught her breath and kept it prisoner behind tight lips. Was he speaking to her? Had her all-knowing father somehow divined that she was hidden where she should not be? A sigh from Father. Sorrow? Love? Weariness? And then, poopy. So softly, so quietly, a broken word from a broken man. Rose had been learning French from Miss Tranton, and she knew what poopy meant. Little baby doll.
Poopy,
Father said again. Where are you, my Georgiana? Rose released her breath, relieved that he had not discerned her presence, aggrieved that such soft tones did not describe her name. And as she pressed her cheek against the desk, Rose promised herself that one day someone would speak her name that way.
Put your hand down, Mr. Sergeant was exasperated now. If you continue to move it, I'll paint you with three, and that's how you'll be remembered evermore.
Eliza heaved a sigh, knotted her hands behind her back. Rose's eyes were glazed from holding the one position, and she blinked a few times. Father had left the room now, but his presence lingered, the same unhappy feeling that always trailed after him. Rose let her gaze rest once more on her scrapbook. The fabric was such a pretty shade of pink, one she knew would suit her dark hair well. Throughout her years of sickness, there was only one thing Rose had ever wanted, and that was to grow up. To escape the bounds of childhood and live, as Millie Thiel had put it so perfectly in Rose's favorite book, however briefly and brokenly. She longed to fall in love, to marry, to have children, to leave Blackhurst and begin a life all her own, away from this house, away from this sofa that Mama insisted she recline upon even when she felt quite well. Rose's sofa, Mama called it. Put a new throw rug on Rose's sofa, something that will pick up the paleness of her skin, make her hair look shinier. And the day of her escape was drawing near. Rose knew it. At long last, Mama had agreed that Rose was well enough to meet a suitor. Over the past few months, Mama had arranged luncheons with a procession of eligible young, and not so young, men. They'd all been fools. Eliza had entertained Rose for hours after each visit with her reenactments and impersonations, but it was good practice. For the perfect gentleman was out there somewhere, waiting for her. He would be nothing like Father. He would be an artist, with an artist's sense of beauty and possibility, who didn't care two whits about bricks and bugs, who was open and easy to read, whose passions and dreams brought light to his eyes. And he would love her, and only her. Beside her, Eliza huffed impatiently.
Really, Mr. Sergeant, she said, I should paint myself faster.
Her husband would be like Eliza, Rose realized, a smile pulling at her placid expression. The gentleman she sought was the male incarnation of her cousin. And finally, their captor set them free. Tennyson was right. To rust unburnished was inconceivably dull. Eliza hurried out of the ridiculous dress Aunt Adeline had insisted upon for the portrait. It was one of Rose's from a season ago. Lace that itched, satin that clung, and a shade of red that made Eliza feel like strawberry pulp. Such a pointless waste of time, losing a morning to a grumpy old man intent on capturing their images so that they too could be hung, lonely and static, upon some chilly wall. Eliza hopped down on hands and knees and peered beneath her bed, lifted the corner of the floorboard she'd loosened long ago. She reached her hand inside and pulled out the story, The Changeling, ran her hand across the black and white cover, felt the ripples of her own penmanship beneath her fingertips. It was Davies who had suggested she put her tales to paper. She'd been helping him plant new roses when a grey and white bird with a striped tail had flown to a low bough nearby.
"Cuckoo," said Davies. "Winter's in Africa, but returns here in the spring."
"I wish I were a bird," said Eliza. "Then I should simply run towards the cliff top and glide over the edge, all the way to Africa, or India, or Australia."
"Australia?"
It was the destination that currently held her imagination in its grip. Mary's eldest brother, Patrick, had emigrated recently with his young family to a place called Maryborough, where his aunt Eleanor had settled some years before. Despite this family connection, Mary liked to think the name had also swayed his choice, and could often be probed for details of the exotic land, floating in a far-off ocean on the other side of the globe. Eliza had found Australia on the schoolroom map, a strange, giant continent in the Southern Ocean, with two ears, one pointed, one broken.
"I know a fellow went to Australia,"
said Davies, pausing a minute in his planting.
"Got himself a farm of 1,000 acres, and couldn't get a thing to grow."
Eliza bit her lip and tasted excitement. This extremism was in line with her own impression of the place.
"They've got a giant sort of rabbit there," Mary says. "Kangaroos, they call them. Feet as long as a grown man's leg."
"I don't know what you'd do with yourself in a place like that, Miss Eliza. Nor Africa, nor India, neither."
Eliza knew exactly what she'd do. "I'm going to collect stories. Ancient stories that no one here has heard before. I'll be just like the Brothers Grimm I was telling you about." Davies frowned.
"Why you'd want to be like your pair of grim old German fellows is beyond me. You should be writing down your own stories, not those belonging to others."
And so she had. She'd begun by writing a story for Rose, a birthday gift, a fairy story about a princess who was turned by magic into a bird. It was the first story she'd ever trapped on paper, and to see her thoughts and ideas turned concrete was curious. It made her skin seem unusually sensitive, strangely exposed and vulnerable. Breezes were cooler, the sun warmer. She couldn't decide whether the sensation was one she liked or loathed. But Rose had always loved Eliza's stories, and Eliza had no greater gift to give. Thus was it the perfect choice. For in the years since Eliza had been plucked from her lonely London life and transplanted to the grand and mysterious Blackhurst, Rose had become a soulmate. She'd laughed and longed with Eliza, and gradually come to fill the space where Sammy once had lodged, the dark, empty hole belonging to all single twins. In return, there was nothing Eliza would not do or give, or write for Rose. The Changeling by Eliza Makepeace. In the olden time, when magic lived and breathed, there was a queen who longed for a child. She was a sad queen, for the king was oft away, leaving her with little to do but dwell upon her own loneliness, and wonder how it was that her husband, whom she loved so well, could bear to be parted from her so long and so often. It happened that many years before, the king had stolen the throne from its rightful ruler, the fairy queen, and the beautiful, peaceful land of fairy had overnight become a desolate place in which magic no longer flourished and laughter was banished. So wrathful was the king that he determined to capture the fairy queen and force her back to the kingdom. A golden cage was prepared specially that he might imprison the fairy queen and impel her to make magic for his pleasure. One winter's day, while the king was away, the queen sat by an open window, gazing out across the snow-laden ground. She was weeping as she sat, for the desolation of the winter months had a habit of reminding the queen of her own loneliness. As she took in the barren winter landscape, she thought of her own barren womb, empty as ever, despite her longing. "Oh, how I wish for a child," she cried. "A beautiful daughter with a heart of truth and eyes that never fill with tears. Then need I never be lonely again." Winter passed, and the world around began to wake. The birds returned to the kingdom and set about readying their nests. Deer could be seen once more grazing where the fields met the woods, and buds burst forth upon the branches of the kingdom's trees. As the new season's skylarks took to the air, the queen's skirt began to tighten around her middle, and by she realized she was with child. The king had not been back to the castle, and thus the queen knew that a mischievous fairy, far from home and hidden in the winter garden, must have heard her weeping and granted her wish by magic. The queen grew and grew, and winter came once more, and on Christmas Eve, as a deep snow fell across the land, the queen began to pain. All night she labored, and on the last chime of midnight her daughter was born, and the queen was able to look at last upon her baby's face. To think that this beautiful child, with pale, unblemished skin, dark hair and red lips in the shape of a rosebud, was all hers. "Rosalind," the queen said. "I shall name her Rosalind." The queen was instantly smitten, and refused to let the Princess Rosalind out of her sight. Loneliness had made the queen bitter, bitterness had made her selfish, and selfishness had made her suspicious. At every turn the queen worried that someone was waiting to steal the child from her. "She is mine," thought the queen, "my salvation. Thus must I keep her for myself." On the morning of the Princess Rosalind's christening, the wisest women in all the land were invited to bring their blessings. All day the queen watched as wishes for grace and prudence and wit rained upon the child. Finally, when night began its creep into the kingdom, the queen bid the wise women farewell. Her back was turned, but briefly, yet when she looked again upon her child, she saw that one guest remained. A traveller in a long cloak stood by the crib, staring down at the infant. "It is late, wise woman," said the queen. "The princess has been blessed, and must now be allowed her sleep." The traveller pushed back her cloak, and the queen gasped, for the face was not that of a wise maiden, but a wizened crone with a toothless smile. "I come with a message from the fairy queen," said the crone. "The girl is one of ours. Thus must she come with me." "No," cried the queen, rushing to the crib side. "She is my daughter, my precious baby girl." "Yours," said the crone, "this glorious child." And she began to laugh, a cruel cackle that made the queen draw back in horror.
She was yours only as long as we let you keep her. In your heart you have always known she was born of fairy dust, and now must you give her up.
The queen wept then, for the crone's pronouncement was all that she had feared.
I cannot give her up, she said. Have mercy, crone, and let me keep her longer.
Now it so happened that the crone liked to cause mischief, and at the queen's words a slow smile spread across her face.
I offer you a choice, she said. Relinquish the child now, and her life will be long and happy, spent at the fairy queen's knee.
Or, said the queen,
or you may keep her here until the morning of her 18th birthday, when her true destiny will come for her, and she will leave you forever. Think carefully, for to keep her longer is to love her deeper.
I don't need to think upon it, said the queen. I choose the second.
The crone smiled so that the dark gaps in her mouth showed.
She is yours then, but only until the morning of her 18th year.
At that moment, the baby princess began to cry for the first time ever. The queen turned to scoop the child into her arms, and when she looked back, the crone was gone. The princess grew to be a beautiful little girl, full of joy and light. She bewitched the ocean with her singing and brought smiles to the faces of all throughout the land. All, that is, except the queen, who was too plagued by fear to enjoy her child. When her daughter sang, the queen did not hear. When her daughter danced, the queen did not see. When her daughter reached out, the queen did not feel, for she was too busy calculating the time left before the child was to be taken from her. As the years passed, the queen grew ever more afraid of the cold, dark event that lurked around the corner. Her mouth forgot how to smile, and the lines about her forehead learned how to hold their creases. Then one night she had a dream in which the crone appeared.
"Your daughter is almost 10," said the crone. "Do not forget that her destiny will find her on her 18th birthday."
"I've changed my mind," said the queen. "I cannot let her go. I will not let her go."
"You gave your word," said the crone. "Thus must it be honored."
The next morning, after making sure the princess was safely under guard, the queen put on her riding habit and sent for her horse. Although magic had been banished from the castle, there was one place where spells and sorcery might still be found. In a black cave on the edge of the enchanted sea lived a fairy who was neither good nor bad. She had been punished by the fairy queen for using magic unwisely, and had thus remained hidden while the rest of the magic folk had fled the land. And although the queen knew it was dangerous to seek the fairy's help, she had no other hope. The queen rode for 3 days and 3 nights, and when she finally arrived at the cave, the fairy was waiting for her.
"Come," she said, "and tell me what it is you seek."
The queen told of the crone and her promise to return on the princess's 18th birthday, and the fairy listened. Then, when the queen was finished, the fairy said, "I cannot undo the crone's curse, but I may help you still."
"I order you to do so," said the queen.
"I must warn you, my queen, that when you hear what I propose, you may not thank me for my help." And the fairy leaned over and whispered in the queen's ear. The queen did not hesitate, for surely anything was better than losing her child to the crone.
"It must be done."
So the fairy handed the queen a potion and instructed her to give the princess 3 drops on each of 3 nights.
"All will then be as I promised," she said. "The crone will trouble you no more, for only the princess's true destiny will find her."
The Queen hastened home, her mind easy for the first time since her daughter's christening. And for the next 3 nights, she placed 3 drops of the potion into her daughter's milk glass. On the 3rd night, when the princess drank of her glass, she began to choke, and as she fell from her chair, she was changed from a princess into a beautiful bird, just as the fairy had foretold. The bird fluttered about the room, and the queen called for her servant to fetch the golden cage from the king's quarters. The bird was shut inside, the golden door was closed, and the queen breathed a sigh of relief. For the king had been clever, and his cage, once closed, could not be reopened. "There now, my pretty," said the queen. "You are safe, and none shall ever take you from me." And then the queen hung the cage from a hook in the highest turret of the castle. With the princess trapped in the cage, all light went out of the kingdom, and the subjects of Fairyland were sunk into an eternal winter in which crops and fertile lands failed. All that kept the people from despair was the princess bird's songs, sad and beautiful, which drifted from the turret window and spilled across the barren land. Time passed, as time must, and royal princes made brave by greed came from far and wide to release the trapped princess. For it was said that in the arid kingdom of Fairyland there was a golden cage so precious it made their own fortunes seem humble, and a caged bird whose songs were so beautiful that gold pieces had been known to fall from the sky when she sang. But all who tried to open the cage dropped dead as soon as they touched it. The queen, who sat day and night in her rocking chair guarding the cage so that none might steal her prize, laughed when she saw the princes slain, for fear and suspicion had finally conspired to drive her mad. Some years after, the youngest son of a woodcutter came to the forest from a distant land. While he was working, there arrived upon the breeze a melody so glorious that he stopped mid-stroke and remained as still as if he had been turned to stone, listening to every note. Unable to help himself, he laid down his axe and went in search of the bird that could sing so sadly and so splendidly. As he made his way through the overgrown forest, birds and beasts appeared to help him, and the woodcutter's son made sure to thank them, for he was a gentle soul who could communicate with all in nature. He climbed through brambles, ran across fields, scaled mountains, slept at night in hollow trees, ate only fruits and nuts, until finally he arrived at the castle walls. "How came you into this forsaken land?" said the guard. "I followed the song of your beautiful bird." "Turn back if you value your life," said the guard, "for all in this kingdom is cursed, and whosoever touches the sad bird's cage shall be lost." "I have nothing to love nor lose," said the woodcutter's son, "and I must see for myself the source of such glorious singing." It so happened that just in that instant the princess bird attained her 18th year, and she began to sing the saddest and most beautiful song of all, lamenting the loss of her youth and her freedom. The guard stood aside, and the young man crossed into the castle and climbed the stairs to the highest turret. When the woodcutter's son saw the trapped bird, his heart was full of care, for he liked to see neither bird nor beast imprisoned. He looked beyond the gold cage and saw only the bird inside. He reached for the cage door, and at his touch it sprang open, and the bird was set free. At that moment the bird was transformed into a beautiful woman with long hair that swirled about her and a crown of glistening seashells upon her head. Birds came from distant trees, and from their beaks showered her with pieces of shining flint that clung to her so that she was attired all in silver. Animals returned to the kingdom, and crops and flowers began instantly to grow from the barren soil. The following day, as the sun rose brilliant over the ocean, a thundering sound could be heard, and 6 enchanted horses appeared at the castle gates, dragging a golden carriage behind. The fairy queen stepped from inside, and all her subjects bowed down. Following her was the fairy from the sea cave, who had proved herself most certainly good by doing her true queen's bidding and ensuring that the Princess Rosalind was ready when her destiny came for her. Under the fairy queen's watchful eye, the Princess Rosalind and the woodcutter's son were married, and the joy of the young couple was so great that magic returned to the land, and all in fairyland were thenceforward free and happy. Excepting, of course, the queen, who was nowhere to be found. In her place was a huge, ugly bird with a cry so horrid it made the blood curdle of all who heard it. It was chased from the land and flew to a distant wood, where it was killed and eaten by the king, who had been driven to madness and despair by his wicked and unfruitful hunt for the fairy queen. Chapter 31, Blackhurst Manor, 1907. There was a blunt knock at the door, and Eliza hid the changeling behind her back, felt her cheeks flush with anticipation. Mary hurried in, curls messier than ever. Her hair always gave fair indication of her mood, and Eliza was left in little doubt that the kitchen was abuzz with birthday preparations. "Mary! I was expecting Rose."
"Miss Eliza."
Mary pressed her lips together, an unusually prim gesture, and one that made Eliza laugh.
"The master wishes to see you, miss."
"My uncle wishes to see me." Though she had roamed far and wide across the estate, in the years she'd been at Blackhurst, Eliza had barely encountered her uncle. He was a shadowy figure who spent most of his time touring the continent in search of bugs, the images of which he stole for his dark room.
"Come now, Miss Eliza," said Mary. "Look sharp."
Mary was more serious than Eliza had ever seen her. She went quickly along the hall and down the narrow back stairs, and Eliza had to scurry to keep up. At the bottom, instead of turning left to the main part of the house, Mary turned right and hurried along a quiet passageway, dim for having fewer whispering lanterns than elsewhere in the house. There were no pictures either, Eliza noticed. Indeed, little attempt at decoration had been made along the cool, dark walls. When they reached the furthest door, Mary stopped. As she was about to open it, she glanced over her shoulder and gave Eliza's hand a slight squeeze, completely unexpected. Before Eliza could ask what the matter was, the door was open and Mary was announcing her.
"Miss Eliza, your lordship."
And then she was gone, and Eliza was alone on the threshold to her uncle's lair, subject to a most peculiar smell. He was seated behind a large wooden desk at the back of the room.
"You wish to see me, uncle?"
The door closed behind her. Uncle Linus peered over his glasses. Once again,